the press into place. In the other corner of the mill room, two men whom Homer Wells didn't know were bottling at high speed. One of the men began to laugh, and his partner started to laugh with him so loudly that Mr. Rose called out to them, "What's so funny?" One of the men explained that his cigarette had fallen out of his mouth into the vat. At this announcement, even Jack and Orange began to laugh, and Homer Wells smiled. But Mr. Rose said quietly, "Then you better fish it out. Nobody wants that mucking up the cider." The men were quiet now. Just the machinery went on with its sluicing and screaming. "Go on," Mr. Rose repeated. "Go fish." The man with the lost cigarette stared into the 1,000-gallon vat. It was only half full, but it was still a swimming pool. He took off his rubber boots, but Mr. Rose said, "Not just the boots. Take off all your clothes, and then go take a shower. And be quick about it. We got work to do." "What?" the man said. "I ain't gonna strip and go wash just to go swimming in there." "You're filthy all over," said Mr. Rose. "Be quick about it." "Hey, you can be quick about it," the man said to Mr. Rose. "You want that butt out of there, you can fish it out yourself." It was Orange who spoke to the man. "What business you in?" Orange asked him. "Hey, what?" the man asked. "What business you in, man?" Orange asked. "Say, you in the apple business, man," Jack advised the man. "Say what?" the man asked. "Just say you in the apple business, man," Orange said. It was at that moment that Mr. Rose took Homer's arm and said to him, "You got to see the view from the roof, my friend." The tug at his elbow was firm but gentle. Mr. Rose very gracefully led Homer out of the mill room, then outside by the kitchen door. "You know what business Mr. Rose is in, man?" Homer heard Orange asking. "He in the knife business, man," he heard Jack say. "You don't want to go in the knife business with Mr. Rose," Homer heard Orange say. "You just stay in the apple business. You do fine, man," Jack said. Homer was following Mr. Rose up the ladder to the roof when he heard the shower turn on. It was an inside shower, more private than the shower at York Farm. Except for their cigarettes, the men on the roof were hard to see, but Homer held Mr. Rose's hand and followed him along the plank on the rooftop until they found two good seats. "You all know Homer," Mr. Rose said to the men on the roof. There was a blur of greetings. The man called Hero was up there, and the man called Branches. There was someone named Willie, and two or three people Homer didn't know, and the old cook whose name was Black Pan. The cook was the shape of a stew pot. It had required some effort for him to gain his perch on the roof. Someone handed Homer a bottle of beer, but the bottle was warm and full of rum. "It stopped again," Branches said, and everyone stared toward the sea. The nightlife lights of Cape Kenneth were so low along the horizon that some of the lights themselves were not visible, only the reflections from them, especially when the lights were cast out over the ocean. But the high Ferris wheel blazed brightly. It was holding still, loading new riders, letting off the old. "Maybe it's stopped to breathe," Branches said, and everyone laughed at that. Someone suggested that it stopped to fart, and everyone laughed louder. Then Willie said, "When it gets too close to the ground, it has to stop, I think." And everyone appeared to consider this seriously. Then the Ferris wheel started again, and the men on the roof of the cider house released a reverential moan. "There it go again," Hero said. "It like a star," Black Pan, the old cook, said. "It look real cool, but you get too close, it burn you. It hotter than a flame."
"It's a Ferris wheel," said Homer Wells.
"It a what?" Willie said.
"A what wheel?" Branches asked.
"A Ferris wheel," said Homer Wells. "That's the Cape Kenneth Carnival, and that's the Ferris wheel."
Mr. Rose nudged him in the ribs, but Homer didn't understand. No one spoke for a long time, and when Homer looked at Mr. Rose, Mr. Rose softly shook his head.
"I heard of something like that," Black Pan said. "I think they had one in Charleston."
"It stopped again," Hero observed. It's letting off passengers, riders, said Homer Wells. It's taking on new riders.
People ride that fucking thing? Branches asked.
Don't ship me, Homer, Hero said. Again, Homer felt the nudge in his ribs, and Mr. Rose said mildly,
You all so uneducated. Homer's having a little fun with you.
When the bottle of rum passed from man to man, Mr. Rose just passed it along.
Don't the name Homer mean nothing to you?
Mr. Rose asked the men.
I think I heard of it, the cook Black Pan said.
Homer was the world's first storyteller, Mr. Rose announced. The nudge at Homer's ribs was back, and Mr. Rose said,
Our Homer knows a good story, too.
Shit, someone said after a while.
What kind of wheel you call it, Homer? Branches asked.
A Ferris wheel, said Homer Wells.
Yeah, someone said.
Everyone laughed.
A fucking Ferris wheel, Hero said. That's pretty good.
One of the men Homer didn't know rolled off the roof. Everyone waited until he was on the ground before they called down to him.
You all right, asshole? Black Pan asked.
Yeah, the man said, and everyone laughed. When Mr. Rose heard the shower start up again, he knew that his bottle man had found the cigarette and was washing the cider off himself.
Willie and Hero, you're bottling now, said Mr. Rose.
I bottled last time, Hero said.
Then you getting real good at it, said Mr. Rose.
I'll press for a while, someone said.
Jack and Orange are going good, Mr. Rose said. We'll just let them go for a while.
Homer sensed that he should leave the roof with Mr. Rose. They helped each other with the ladder. On the ground, Mr. Rose spoke very seriously to Homer.
You got to understand, Mr. Rose whispered. They don't want to know what that thing is. What good it do them to know?
Okay, said Homer Wells, who stood a long while out of the range of the lights blazing in the mill room. Now that he was more familiar with their dialect, he could occasionally understand the voices from the roof.
It's stopped again, he heard Branches say.
Yeah, it's taken on riders,
someone said, and everyone laughed.
You know, maybe it's an army place, Black Pan said.
What army? Someone asked.
We almost at war, Black Pan said. I heard that.
Shit, someone said.
It's something for the airplanes to see, Black Pan said.
Whose airplanes? Hero asked.
There it go again, Branches said.
Homer Wells walked back through the orchards to the Worthington house. He was touched that Mrs. Worthington had left the light over the stairs on for him, and when he saw the light under her bedroom door, he said quietly, Good night, Mrs. Worthington. I'm back.
Good night, Homer, she said.
He looked out Wally's window for a while. There was no way, at that distance, that he could witness the reaction on the cider house roof when the Ferris wheel in Cape Kenneth was shut off for the night. When all the lights went out with a blink, what did the men on the roof have to say about that, he wondered. Maybe they thought that the Ferris wheel came from another planet, and when all the lights were out, that it had returned there. And wouldn't Fuzzy Stone have loved to see it, thought Homer Wells, and Curly Day and Young Copperfield? And it would have been fun to ride it with Melanie, just once, to see what she would have said about it. Dr. Larch wouldn't be impressed. Was anything a mystery to Dr. Larch? In the morning, Mr. Rose chose to rest his magic hands between trees. He came up to Homer, who was working as a checker in the orchard called Frying Pan, counting the one-bushel crates before they were loaded on the flatbed trailer, and giving every picker credit for each bushel picked.
I want you to show me that wheel, Mr. Rose said, smiling.
The Ferris wheel? Said Homer Wells.
If you don't mind showing me, said Mr. Rose, there just can't be no talk about it.
Right, Homer said. We better go soon before it gets any colder and they close it for the season. I bet it's pretty cold riding it now.
I don't know if I want to ride it until I see it, said Mr. Rose.
Sure, said Homer. Mrs. Worthington let him take the van, but when he picked up Mr. Rose at the cider house, everyone was curious.
"We've got to check something in the far orchard," Mr. Rose told the men. "What far orchard he talking about?"
Black Pan asked Kiro, when Homer and Mr. Rose got in the van. Homer Wells remembered his ride on the Ferris wheel with Wally. It was much colder now, and Mr. Rose was subdued all the way to Cape Kenneth, and uncharacteristically drawn into himself as they walked through the carnival together. The summer crowd was gone. Some of the carnival events were already closed up tight.
"Don't be nervous," Homer said to Mr. Rose. "The Ferris wheel is perfectly safe."
"I'm not nervous about no wheel," said Mr. Rose. "You see a lot of people my color around here?"
Homer had detected nothing hostile in the looks from the people. As an orphan, he always suspected that people singled him out to stare at, and so he had not felt especially singled out in the company of Mr. Rose. But now he noticed more of the looks, and realized that the looks an orphan might detect were only imagined by comparison. When they got to the Ferris wheel, there was no line, but they had to wait for the ride in progress to be over. When the wheel stopped, Homer and Mr. Rose got on and sat together in one chair.
"We could each sit in our own chairs if you prefer," said Homer Wells.
"Keep it like it is," said Mr. Rose. When the wheel began its ascent, he sat very still and straight and held his breath until they were nearly at the top of the rise.
"Over there's the orchard," pointed Homer Wells. But Mr. Rose stared straight ahead, as if the stability of the entire Ferris wheel relied on each rider's maintaining perfect balance.
"What's so special about doing this?" asked Mr. Rose rigidly.
"It's just for the ride, and the view, I guess," said Homer Wells.
"I like the view from the roof," Mr. Rose said. When they started the descent of the wheel turn, Mr. Rose said, "It's a good thing I didn't eat much today."
By the time they passed ground level and began their ascent again, a substantial crowd had formed, but they didn't appear to be standing in line for the next ride. There were only two couples and one boy by himself sharing the wheel with Homer and Mr. Rose, and when they were at the top of the wheel turn again, Homer realized that the crowd below them had formed to stare at Mr. Rose.
"They come to see if niggers fly," Mr. Rose said, "but I ain't going nowhere, not for no one's entertainment. They come to see if the machine is going to break down trying to carry a nigger, or maybe they want to see me throw up."
"Just don't do anything," Homer Wells said.
"That's the advice I've been hearing all my life, boy," Mr. Rose said. As they started their descent, Mr. Rose leaned out of the chair, quite dangerously farther than was necessary, and vomited in a splendid arc over the crowd below them. The crowd moved as one, but not everyone moved in time.
When their chair was at the bottom of the descent again, the Ferris wheel was stopped so that the sick man could get off. The crowd had retreated, except for a young man who was especially splattered. As Homer Wells and Mr. Rose were leaving the Ferris wheel grounds, the young man came forward and said to Mr. Rose,
"You look like you meant to do that."
"Who means to get sick?" said Mr. Rose. He kept walking, and Homer kept up with him. The young man was about Homer's age. He should have homework, thought Homer Wells. If he's still in school, it's a school night.
"I think you meant to," the young man said to Mr. Rose, who stopped walking away then.
"What business you in?" Mr. Rose asked the boy.
"What?" the young man asked, but Homer Wells stepped between them.
"My friend is sick," Homer Wells said. "Please, just leave him alone."
"Your friend?" the boy said.
"Ask me what business I'm in," Mr. Rose said to the boy.
"What fucking business are you in, mister?" the young man shouted at Mr. Rose.
Homer felt himself neatly shoved out of the way. He saw that Mr. Rose was standing, very suddenly, chest to chest with the boy. There was no sour smell of vomit on Mr. Rose's breath, however. Somehow, Mr. Rose had slipped one of those mints in his mouth. The alertness that had been missing when Mr. Rose felt ill was back in his eyes. The boy seemed surprised that he was standing so close to Mr. Rose and so suddenly. He was a little taller and quite a bit heavier than Mr. Rose, yet he looked unsure of himself.
"I said, what fucking business are you in, mister?" the boy repeated, and Mr. Rose smiled.
"I'm in the throwing up business," Mr. Rose said in a humble manner.
Someone in the crowd laughed. Homer Wells felt a surge of vast relief. Mr. Rose smiled in such a way that allowed the boy to smile, too.
"Sorry if any of it got on you," Mr. Rose said nicely.
"No problem," said the young man, turning to leave. After taking a few steps, the boy turned inquisitively in Mr. Rose's direction, but Mr. Rose had grasped Homer Wells by the arm and was already walking on. Homer saw shock on the boy's face. The young man's flannel jacket, which was still zipped shut, was flapping wide open. A single crisp slash had slit it from the collar to the waist, and every button on the boy's shirt was gone. The boy gaped at himself, and then at Mr. Rose, who did not look back, and then the boy allowed himself to be pulled into the comfort of the crowd.
"How'd you do that?" Homer asked Mr. Rose when they reached the van.
"Your hand's got to be fast," Mr. Rose said. "Your knife got to be sharp. But you do it with your eyes. Your eyes keep their eyes off your hands."
The wide-open jacket of the boy made Homer remember Clara, and how a scalpel made no mistakes. Only a hand made mistakes. His chest was cold, and he was driving too fast. When Homer turned off Drinkwater Road and drove through the orchards to the cider house, Mr. Rose said,
"You see, I was right, wasn't I? What good is it to apple pickers to know about that wheel?"
"It does no good to know about it," thought Homer Wells.
"And what good would it do Melanie to know about it, or Curly Day, or Fuzzy, or any Bedouin?"
"Am I right?" Mr. Rose demanded.
"Right," said Homer Wells.
Chapter 8. Opportunity Knocks. After the harvest at York Farm, the foreman asked Melanie to stay on to help with the mousing.
"We have to get the mice before the ground freezes, or else they'll have the run of the orchards all winter," the foreman explained.
The men used poison oats and poison corn, scattering the poison around the trees and putting it in the pine mice tunnels. Poor mice, thought Melanie, but she tried mousing for a few days. When she saw a pine mouse tunnel, she tried to conceal it. She never put any poison in it. And she only pretended to scatter the oats and corn around the trees. She didn't like the way the poison smelled. She would dump it into the dirt road and fill her bag with sand and gravel and scatter that instead.
"Have a nice winter, mice," she whispered to them.
It began to get very cold in the cider house. They gave her a wood-burning stove, which Melanie vented through a window in the bunk room. The stove kept the toilet from freezing. The morning the outdoor shower was frozen was the morning Melanie decided to move on. She only briefly regretted not being able to stay and save more mice.
"If you're looking for another orchard," the foreman warned her, "you won't find any that's hiring in the winter."
"I'd like a city job for the winter," Melanie told him.
"What city?" the foreman asked.
Melanie shrugged. She had securely strapped up her small bundle of things in Charlie's belt. The sleeves of Mrs. Grogan's coat reached only halfway down her forearms, and the coat was an especially tight fit across the shoulders and the hips. Even so, Melanie managed to look comfortable in it.
"There's no real cities in Maine," the foreman told her.
"It won't take much of a city to be a city for me," said Melanie.
He watched her walk to the same part of the road where he'd called goodbye to her before. It was that time of year when the trees are bare and the sky looks like lead, and underfoot the ground feels more unyielding every day. Yet it's too early for snow, or else there's a freak storm and the snow doesn't last. For some reason the foreman felt a strong desire to leave with Melanie. He surprised himself by muttering out loud, "I hope it snows soon."
"What?" one of the Applemart women said.
"So long," the foreman called to Melanie, but she didn't answer him.
"Good riddance," said one of the women in the mart.
"The slut," another one said. "What makes her a slut?" the foreman asked sharply. "Who you seen her sleeping with?"
"She's just a tramp," one of them said.
"At least she's interesting," the foreman snapped.
The women regarded him for a moment before one of them spoke up.
"Got a crush on her, do you?" she asked. "I bet you wish you was that boyfriend she's looking for," another woman said, which drew a teasing sort of laughter from all the mart women.
"It's not that," the foreman snapped. "I hope she never finds that boyfriend. For his sake," the foreman said,
And for hers, he added.
The woman whose fat husband had tried to rape Melanie turned away from this conversation. She opened the large communal thermos on the table next to the cash register, but when she tried to pour herself some coffee, none came out. What came out instead was poison oats and poison corn. If Melanie had actually meant to poison any of them, she would have been more restrained in the proportions. It was clearly just a message, and the Applemart women regarded it as silently as if they were trying to read bones. "You see what I mean?" the foreman asked them. He picked up an apple from a display basket on the counter and took a healthy chomp. The apple had been left out in the cold so long that it was partially frozen, and so mealy in the foreman's mouth that he instantly spat it out. It was very cold on the road to the coast, but the walking warmed Melanie up. Also, since there was no traffic, she had no choice about walking. When she reached the coastal highway, she didn't have to wait long for a ride. A pale but jolly boy driving a panel truck stopped for her.
"Yarmouth Paint and Shellac at your service," the boy said to Melanie.
He was a little younger than Homer Wells, and, in Melanie's opinion, not nearly so worldly-looking. The truck reeked of wood-stained smells and of varnish and creosote.
"I'm a wood-treatment expert," the boy said to her proudly.
At best, a salesman, Melanie thought, more likely a delivery boy. She smiled tightly, not showing her chipped teeth. The boy fidgeted, awaiting some form of greeting from her. "I can make anyone nervous in less than a minute," Melanie thought.
"Where you going?"
the boy asked her, the panel truck sloshing along.
"The city,"
Melanie said.
"What city?" the boy asked.
Now Melanie allowed her lips to part with her smile. The worried boy now stared at the troubled history of her mouth.
"You tell me,"
Melanie said.
"I got to go to Bath," the boy said nervously.
Melanie stared at him as if he'd said he had to have a bath.
"Bath,"
she repeated.
"It's a city, sort of,"
the wood treatment expert told her.
It was Clara's city, Dr. Larch or Homer Wells could have told Melanie. Old Clara had come to St. Cloud's from Bath.
But Melanie didn't know that and wouldn't have cared. Her relationship to Clara had been unpleasantly envious. Homer Wells knew Clara more intimately than he knew Melanie. It might have interested Melanie that Bath would put her much closer to Ocean View than she'd been at York Farm, that there might even be residents of Bath who would have heard of an Ocean View Orchards. There were certainly many Bath residents who could have directed her to Hart's Haven or to Hart's Rock.
"You want to go to Bath?"
the boy asked her cautiously.
Again Melanie showed her damaged teeth. She was displaying less of a smile than of the manner in which a dog might show its hackles.
"Right," she said.
Wally came home for Thanksgiving. Candy had been home for several weekends in the early fall, but Homer had not known how to initiate seeing her without Wally. Wally was surprised that Homer and Candy hadn't seen each other, and from Candy's embarrassment with Wally's surprise, Homer detected that she had been equally troubled about initiating a meeting with him. But the turkey had to be basted every 15 minutes, the table had to be set, and Olive was too obviously enjoying having a full house again. There was no time to feel awkward. Raymond Kendall had shared a Thanksgiving dinner with the Worthingtons before, but never without Senior's semi-presence. Ray went through a few minutes of struggling to be overly polite before he relaxed and talked shop with Olive.
"Dad acts like he's having a date," Candy said to Olive in the kitchen.
"I'm flattered," Olive said, squeezing Candy's arm and laughing, but that was the end of any further nonsense. Homer volunteered to carve the turkey. He did such a good job that Olive said, "You should be a surgeon, Homer." Wally laughed. Candy looked at her plate, or at her hands in her lap, and Ray Kendall said,
"The boy's just good with his hands. If you've got good hands, once you do a thing, your hands won't forget how."
"That's like you, Ray," Olive said, which moved the attention away from Homer's work with the knife. He carved every bit of meat off the bones as quickly as possible. Wally talked about the war. He said he'd thought about dropping out of college to go to flying school. "So if there is a war, if we get into it, I mean, then I'll already know how to fly."
"You'll do no such thing," Olive said to him.
"Why would you want to do such a thing?" Candy asked him. "I think you're being selfish."
What do you mean, selfish? Wally asked. A war is for your country. It's serving your country.
To you, it's an adventure, Candy said. That's what's selfish about it.
You'll do no such thing anyway, Olive repeated.
I was too young to go to the last war, Ray said, and if there's another one, I'll be too old.
Lucky you, Olive said.
That's right, Candy said.
Ray shrugged.
I don't know, he said. I wanted to go to the last one. I tried to lie about my age, but someone told on me.
Now you know better, Olive said.
I'm not so sure of that, Ray said. If there's a new one, there'll be lots of new weapons. They're building stuff you can't even imagine.
I try to imagine it, Wally said. I imagine the war all the time.
Except the dying, Wally, Olive Worthington said, carrying the turkey carcass out to the kitchen. I don't think you've imagined the dying.
Right, said Homer Wells, who imagined the dying all the time. Candy looked at him and smiled.
You should have called me on the weekends, Homer, she said.
Yeah, why didn't you? Wally asked him. Too busy with Deborah Pettigrew, that's why.
Homer just shook his head.
Too busy with the practical anatomy of the rabbit, Olive called from the kitchen.
The what? Wally said.
But Olive was wrong. It had taken Homer only about 3 weeks of senior biology to realize that he knew more about the particular animal under scrutiny and its relation to human anatomy than did his cadaverous teacher, Mr. Hood. It was, as Wilbur Larch could have guessed, the urogenital system that revealed Mr. Hood's deficiencies in comparison to the experience of young Dr. Wells. In discussing the 3 stages of specialization of the uterus, Mr. Hood became confused. The intrauterine life of the rabbit embryo is only 30 days, between 5 to 8 young are born. In keeping with the primitive nature of the little animal, the rabbit has 2 complete uteri. The structure of the organ at this stage is called uterus duplex. The structure of the organ in the human female, which Homer Wells knew very well, wherein 2 uterine tubes open into a single uterine cavity, is called uterus simplex. The 3rd stage of uterine structure falls between the two, a partially fused condition existing in some mammals, sheep, for example. It is called uterus bicornis. Poor Mr. Hood, attempting to reveal the secrets of the uterus upon the chalky blackboard, confused his duplex with his bicornis. He called a sheep a rabbit, and vice versa. It was a smaller error than if he'd imagined the human female had 2 complete uteri and had spread this misinformation to the class. But it was an error. Homer Wells caught it. It was the first time he'd been put in a position of correcting an authority. An orphan is especially uncomfortable and insecure in such a position, wrote Dr. Wilbur Larch.
Excuse me, sir, said Homer Wells.
Yes, Homer, said Mr. Hood. His gauntness in a certain light made him appear as exposed as the many rabbit cadavers lying open on the students' laboratory tables. He looked skinned, almost ready for labeling. A kind but weary patience was in his eyes. They were the man's only alert features.
"It's the other way around, sir," said Homer Wells.
"Pardon me," said Mr. Hood.
"The rabbit has 2 complete uteri. The rabbit is uterus duplex, not the sheep, sir," Homer said. "The sheep's uterus is partially fused together. It's almost one. The sheep is uterus bicornis." The class waited. Mr. Hood blinked. For a moment he looked like a lizard regarding a fly, but he suddenly retreated.
"Isn't that what I said?" he asked, smiling.
"No," the class murmured. "You said it the other way around."
"Well, it's my mistake, then," Mr. Hood said almost cheerfully. "I meant it just the way you said it, Homer," he said.
"Maybe I misunderstood you, sir," Homer said, but the class murmured, "No, you got it right." The short boy named Bucky, with whom Homer had to share his rabbit cadaver, nudged Homer in the ribs.
"How come you know all about cunts?" he asked Homer.
"Search me," said Homer Wells. He had learned that phrase from Deborah Pettigrew. It was the one game they played. He would ask her something she couldn't answer. She would say, "Search me," and Homer Wells, saying, "Okay," would begin to search her.
"Not there," Deborah would cry, pushing his hand away, but laughing. Always laughing, but always pushing his hand away. There was no way Homer Wells would gain admittance to the uterus simplex of Deborah Pettigrew.
"Not unless I ask her to marry me," he told Wally, when they were back together in Wally's bedroom, Thanksgiving night.
I wouldn't go that far, old boy, Wally said. Homer didn't tell Wally about embarrassing Mr. Hood, or how the man seemed changed by the incident. If Mr. Hood had always been cadaverous, now there was an insomnia about his presence, too, as if he were not only dead, but also working too hard, staying up late, boning up on his rabbit anatomy, trying to keep all the uteri straight. His tiredness made him slightly less cadaverous, but only because exhaustion is a life sign. It is at least a form of being human. Mr. Hood began to look as if he were waiting for his retirement, hoping that he could get there. "Where have I seen that look before?" wondered Homer Wells. Nurse Angela, or Nurse Edna, or even Mrs. Grogan could have reminded him. They were all familiar with that look, that strained combination of exhaustion and expectation, that fierce contradiction between grim anxiety and childlike faith. For years that look had penetrated even the most innocent expressions of Wilbur Larch. Lately, Nurse Angela and Nurse Edna, and even Mrs. Grogan, had recognized the look in their own expressions. "What are we waiting for?" Nurse Edna asked Nurse Angela one morning. There was an aura of something pending, some form of inevitable change. These good women were as insulted by the now-famous Goodhall Gingrich questionnaire as they felt sure Dr. Larch had been. Larch did seem unusually cheered by the remarks of the former Snowy Meadows. The board had thought Snowy's response was so praiseworthy that they'd sent it along for Dr. Larch to see. To the question of being properly supervised, Snowy said that Dr. Larch and the nurses never let him out of their sight. To the question regarding whether or not the medical attention was adequate, Snowy Meadows advised the board to just ask Fuzzy Stone. In Snowy's opinion, Dr. Larch had breathed for Fuzzy. "You never heard a worse set of lungs," said Snowy Meadows, "but old Larch just hooked the kid up to a real lifesaver." And to the question of whether or not the foster home was carefully and correctly chosen, Snowy Meadows claimed that Dr. Larch was a genius at this delicate guesswork. "How could the guy have known that I was going to fit right in with a furniture family?" "Well, I'm telling you, he did know," Snowy Meadows, now Robert Marsh, wrote to the board. "You know, private property, the world of personal possessions, that doesn't mean the world to everybody. But let me tell you," Snowy Meadows said, "furniture means the world to an orphan." "One of you must have dropped that boy on his head," Wilbur Larch said to Nurse Edna and to Nurse Angela, although they could tell he was very pleased by Snowy's remarks. But just to be fair, the board sent Larch Curly Day's slightly less enthusiastic response to the questionnaire. Roy Rinfret of Booth Bay was seething with resentment. "I was no more prepared to be adopted by druggists than I was prepared to have my belly cord cut," wrote Roy Curly Rinfret. "The most beautiful couple in the world walked off with someone who didn't even need or want to be adopted, and I got nabbed by druggists," Curly complained. "You call it being supervised when little children are stumbling over dead bodies?" Curly Day asked the board. "Imagine this. On the day I find a dead man in the grass, the couple of my dreams adopt someone else, Dr. Larch tells me that an orphanage is not a pet store, and shortly thereafter, two druggists hire me to work in their drugstore for free. And you call that being adopted?" "Why, that ungrateful little snot," said Nurse Angela. "Why, Curly Day, aren't you ashamed?" Nurse Edna asked the indifferent air. "If that boy were here," Nurse Angela said, "I'd take him over my knee, I would." "And why hasn't our Homer Wells filled out the questionnaire?" the women wondered. Speaking of ungrateful, thought Wilbur Larch, although he held his tongue. Nurse Angela did not hold hers. She wrote directly to Homer Wells, which would have irritated Dr. Larch if he'd known. Nurse Angela came right to the point. "That questionnaire is the least you can do," she wrote Homer. "We all could use a little support. Just because you're having the time of your life, I suppose, don't you dare forget how to be of use. Don't you forget where you belong. And if you happen to run into any young doctors or nurses who would be sympathetic to our situation, I think you know that you'd better recommend us to them, and them to us. We're not getting any younger, you know." "My dear Homer," wrote Dr. Larch in the next day's mail, "it's come to my attention that the Board of Trustees is attempting to communicate with several former residents of St. Cloud's in the form of a ridiculous questionnaire. Answer it as you see fit, but please do answer it,
and you must be prepared for some other, more troubling correspondence from them. It was necessary for me to be frank with them regarding the health of the orphans. Although I saw no reason to tell them I had lost Fuzzy Stone to a respiratory ailment, what good would that admission do Fuzzy? I did tell the board about your heart. I felt that if anything ever happened to me, there should be someone who knew. I do apologize for not telling you about your condition. I am telling you now because, reconsidering the matter, I would never want you to hear about your heart from someone else first. Now, don't be alarmed. I would not even describe your heart as a condition. The condition is so slight. You had a fairly substantial heart murmur as a small child, but this had almost entirely disappeared when I last checked you. In your sleep, you wouldn't remember. And I have delayed even mentioning your heart to you, for fear of worrying you needlessly. Such worrying might aggravate the condition. You have, or had, a pulmonary valve stenosis, but please don't worry. It is nothing, or next to nothing. If you're interested in more details, I can provide them. For now, I just didn't want you being upset by some fool thing you might hear from that fool board of trustees. Aside from avoiding any situation of extreme stress or extreme exertion, I want you to know that you can almost certainly lead a normal life. A normal life, thought Homer Wells. I am a Bedouin with a heart condition, and Dr. Larch is telling me I can lead a normal life? I am in love with my best and only friend's girlfriend, but is that what Larch would call extreme stress? And what was Melanie to me, if not extreme exertion? Whenever Homer Wells thought of Melanie, which was not often, he missed her. Then he was angry at himself. Why should I miss her? He wondered. He tried not to think about St. Cloud's. The longer he stayed away, the more extreme life there appeared to him. Yet when he thought of it, he missed it too. And Nurse Angela, and Nurse Edna, and Mrs. Grogan, and Dr. Larch, he missed them all. He was angry at himself for that too. There were absolutely no signals from his heart to tell him that the life at St. Cloud's was the life he wanted. He liked the life at Ocean View. He wanted Candy and some life with her. When she went back to Camden, he tried not to think about her. And since he could not think of Wally without thinking of Candy, he was relieved when Wally went back to Orono, although he had missed Wally all that fall. "When an orphan is depressed," wrote Wilbur Larch, "he is attracted to telling lies. A lie is at least a vigorous enterprise. It keeps you on your toes by making you suddenly responsible for what happens because of it. You must be alert to lie, and stay alert to keep your lie a secret. Orphans are not the masters of their fates. They are the last to believe you if you tell them that other people are also not in charge of theirs. When you lie, it makes you feel in charge of your life. Telling lies is very seductive to orphans. I know, Dr. Larch wrote, I know because I tell them too. I love to lie. When you lie, you feel as if you have cheated fate, your own and everybody else's. And so, Homer Wells answered the questionnaire. He sang a hymn of praise to St. Cloud's. He mentioned the restoration of the abandoned buildings of St. Cloud's as one of the many attempts made to integrate the daily life of the orphanage with the life of the surrounding community. He also lied to Nurse Angela, but it was just a little lie, one of those that are intended to make other people feel better. He wrote to her that he had lost the original questionnaire, which was the only reason he had been so tardy in returning it. Perhaps the board would be kind enough to send him another. When he received the second questionnaire from the board, he would know it was time to send the one he had so arduously filled out. That way he would appear to have filled it out spontaneously, off the top of his head. He wrote with feigned calmness to Dr. Larch. He would appreciate further details regarding his pulmonary valve stenosis. Did Dr. Larch think it necessary, for example, for Homer to have monthly checkups? Dr. Larch would think it unnecessary, of course. And were there signs of trouble that Homer himself might detect? Were there ways that he could listen for his perhaps returning murmur? Calm yourself, Dr. Larch would advise. That was the best thing, staying calm. In an effort to calm himself, Homer tacked the extra questionnaire, which he did not fill out, to the wall of Wally's room, right by the light switch, so that the questions regarding life at St. Cloud's occupied a position of ignored authority quite similar to the page of rules that were yearly tacked up in the cider house. As Homer came and went, he regarded those questions he had answered with such able lies. For example, it was quite a kick for him to contemplate any possible improvements in the methods and management of St. Cloud's each time he entered and left Wally's room. At night now, Homer's insomnia kept time to a new music. The winter branches of the picked apple trees, rattling against each other in the early December wind, made a brittle click-clack sound. Lying in his bed, a moonlight the color of bone starkly outlining his hands folded on his chest, Homer Wells thought the trees might be trying to shake the snow off their branches, in advance of the snow itself. Perhaps the trees knew that a war was coming, too, but Olive Worthington didn't think about it. She had heard the orchard's winter rattle for many years. She had seen the winter branches bare, then lacy with snow, and then bare again. The coastal winds gave the brittle orchard such a shaking that the clashing trees resembled frozen soldiers in all the postures of saber rattling. But Olive had heard so many years of this season that she never knew a war was coming. If the trees seemed especially naked to her that December, she thought it was because she faced her first winter without Senior. "Grown-ups don't look for signs in the familiar," noted Dr. Wilbur Larch in A Brief History of St. Cloud's, "but an orphan is always looking for signs." Homer Wells, at Wally's window, searched the skeletal orchard for the future, his own, mainly, but Candy's too, and Wally's. Dr. Larch's future was certainly out there in those winter branches, even Melanie's future. And what future would there be for the Lord's work, wondered Homer Wells. The war that was about to be did not announce itself in signs at St. Cloud's. Both the familiar and the unfamiliar were muted there by ritual and by custom. A pregnancy terminated in a birth or in an abortion. An orphan was adopted or was waiting to be adopted. When there was a dry and snowless cold, the loose sawdust irritated the eyes and the noses and the throats of St. Cloud's. Only briefly, when the snow lay newly fallen, was the sawdust gone from the air. When there was a thaw, the snow melted down and the matted sawdust smelled like wet fur. When there was a freeze, the sawdust reappeared, dry again, somehow on top of the old snow. And again the eyes itched, the noses ran, and the throats could never quite clear themselves of it. "Let us be happy for Smoky Fields," Dr. Larch announced in the boys' division. "Smoky Fields has found a family. Good night, Smoky."
"Good night, Smoky," said David Copperfield.
"Good night," young Steerforth cried.
"Good night, you little food hoarder," Nurse Angela thought. Whoever took him, she knew, would soon learn to lock the refrigerator. In the December morning, at the window where Melanie once allowed the world to pass both with and without comment, Mary Agnes Cork watched the women walking uphill from the train station. "They don't look pregnant," Mary Agnes thought. On the bleak hill where Wally Worthington once imagined apple trees, young Copperfield attempted to steer a cardboard carton through the first wet snow. The carton had once contained 400 sterile Volvo pads. Copperfield knew this because he had unpacked the carton, and he had placed young Steerforth in the carton at the bottom of the hill. Near the top, he was beginning to realize his mistake. Not only had dragging Steerforth uphill been difficult, but also the boy's weight, in addition to the wetness of the snow, had turned the bottom of the carton soggy. Copperfield wondered if this make-do sled would even slide, if he ever managed to get the mess to the top.
"Good night, Smoky," Steerforth was singing.
"Shut up, stupid," David Copperfield said. Dr. Larch was very tired. He was resting in the dispensary. The gray winter light turned the white walls gray, and for a moment, Larch wondered what time of day it was, and what time of year. From now on, he was thinking, let everything I do be for a reason. Let me make no wasted moves. In his mind's eye, he saw the correct angle at which the vaginal speculum allowed him a perfect view of the cervix. Whose cervix? He wondered. Even in his ether sleep, the thumb and index finger of his right hand tightened the screw that held the jaws of the speculum in place, and he saw the astonishing blondness of the little clump of pubic hair caught in the hairs of his own wrist. It was so blonde he had nearly missed seeing it against his own pale skin. When he shook his wrist,
The little clump was so light that it floated in the air. In his ether swoon, his left hand reached for it, just missing. Oh, yes, her cervix, thought Wilbur Larch. What was her name? She has a toy name, Larch said aloud. Candy, he remembered. Then he laughed. Nurse Edna, passing the dispensary, held her breath and listened to the laughter. But even when she didn't breathe, the fumes made her old eyes water. That and the sawdust. That and the orphans. Some of them made her eyes water, too. She opened the door at the hospital entrance to let some fresh air into the hall. On the hill, she watched a cardboard carton make an unsteady descent. She knew that sterile Volvo pads had been in the carton, but she wasn't sure what was in the carton now. Something heavy, because the carton's descent was clumsy and irregular. At times it picked up speed, sliding almost smoothly, but always some rock or bare patch in the slushy snow would jar it off course and slow it down. The first small body to roll out of the carton and make its way downhill was Steerforth's. She recognized his overlarge mittens and the ski hat that always covered his eyes. For a while he tumbled almost as fast as the carton, but a large patch of bare, frozen ground finally stopped him. Nurse Edna watched him climb back uphill for one of his mittens. The second larger body to be propelled from the carton was obviously David Copperfield's. He rolled free with a large, soggy piece of the carton in both his hands. The carton appeared to disintegrate in flight. Fit! David Copperfield cried. At least, Nurse Edna thought, young Copperfield's profanities were improved by his lisp. Close that door, said Dr. Larch, in the hall behind Nurse Edna. I was just trying to get some fresh air, Nurse Edna said pointedly. You could have fooled me, said Wilbur Larch. I thought you were trying to freeze the unborn. Maybe that will be the way of the future, Nurse Edna thought, wondering what future ways there would be. In the December swimming pool, the raft that Senior Worthington used to ride still floated, wind-blown from one end of the pool to the other, breaking up the lacy fringes of ice that formed and reformed around the edges. Olive and Homer had drained out a third of the pool's water to leave room for rainfall and snowmelt. Senior's cold raft, only partially deflated by the falling temperature, still charged around the swimming pool like a riderless horse. It galloped wherever the wind urged it. Every day Olive watched the raft out the kitchen window, and Homer wondered when she would suggest getting rid of it. One weekend, Candy came home from Camden, and Homer's confusion regarding what he should do about her mounted. Friday was a bad, indecisive day. He went early to Senior Biology, hoping to persuade Mr. Hood either to let him have his own rabbit for dissection, or to assign him a lab partner other than that boy, Bucky. Bucky managed to mangle the rabbit's innards whenever he handled them, and Homer found the oaf's constant fixation with everything's reproductive system both silly and maddening. Bucky had lately seized on the fact that marsupials have paired vaginas. "Twin twats! Can you believe it?" Bucky asked Homer. "Right," said Homer Wells. "Is that all you can say?" Bucky asked. "Don't you get it? If you was a hamster, you could fuck another hamster with your buddy." "Why would I want to do that?" Homer asked. "Two cunts," Bucky said enthusiastically. "You got no imagination." "I doubt that even the hamsters are interested in what you suggest," said Homer Wells. "That's what I mean, stupid," Bucky said. "What a waste to give two twats to a hamster. You ever seen 'em run on them little wheels? They're crazy. Wouldn't you be crazy if you knew the girl of your dreams had two twats and she still wasn't interested?" "The girl of my dreams," said Homer Wells. It was crazy enough, in Homer's opinion, that the girl of his dreams had two people who loved her. And so he went early to Senior Biology to request either a fresh rabbit or a replacement for the obsessed boy named Bucky. There was a geography class in progress when he got there, and when the class was released, Homer saw that the large maps of the world were still pulled down, covering the blackboard. "May I just look at the maps for a moment before my next class?" Homer asked the geography teacher. "I'll roll them back up for you." And so he was left alone with his first accurate view of the world. The whole world, albeit unrealistically flat against a blackboard.
After a while, he found Maine. He regarded how small it was. After a while, he found South Carolina. He stared into South Carolina for a long time, as if the exact whereabouts of Mr. Rose and the other migrants would materialize. He had heard all the talk about Germany, which was easier to find than Maine. He was surprised at the size of England. Charles Dickens had given him the impression of something much bigger. And the ocean that seemed so vast when you looked at it off Ray Kendall's dock. Why, the oceans of the world were even more vast than he'd imagined. Yet St. Clouds, which loomed so large in Homer's life, could not be located on the map of Maine. He was using the geography teacher's magnifying glass when he suddenly realized that the entire class of senior biology had filled the seats behind him. Mr. Hood was regarding him strangely. "Looking for your rabbit, Homer?" Mr. Hood asked. The class enjoyed this joke enormously, and Homer realized he had, at least for that day, lost the opportunity to rid himself of Bucky. "Look at it this way," Bucky whispered to him near the end of class. "If Deborah Pettigrew had two twats, she might let you in one of them. You see the advantages?" Unfortunately, the idea of paired vaginas troubled Homer throughout his Friday evening date with Deborah Pettigrew. There was a Fred Astaire movie in Bath, but that was almost an hour-long drive each way, and what did Homer Wells know or care about dancing? He had declined several invitations to attend at Deborah's dancing class with her. If she wanted to see the Fred Astaire movie, Homer thought she could go with someone who was in her dancing class. And it was getting too cold simply to drive down to the beach and park there. Olive was generous about letting Homer use the van. Soon there would be gas rationing and a welcome end, in Homer's opinion, to all this restless driving. He drove Deborah Pettigrew out to the carnival site at Cape Kenneth. In the moonlight, the abandoned, unlighted Ferris wheel stood out like scaffolding for the world's first rocket launch, or like the bones of some species from dinosaur times. Homer tried to tell Deborah about the knife work of Mr. Rose, but she had her heart set on Fred Astaire. He knew better than to waste a good story on her when she was sulking. They drove to the Cape Kenneth drive-in, which was closed for the season. They appeared to be reviewing the scenes of a romance that had happened to other people, and not just last summer, but to another generation. "I don't know what you've got against dancing," Deborah said. "I don't know either," said Homer Wells. It was still early when he drove Deborah to her winter home in Kenneth Corners. The same ferocious dogs of the summer were there, with their coats grown thicker, with their hot breath icing on their muzzles. There had been talk between Deborah and Homer earlier about using the summer house on Drinkwater Lake for some kind of party. The house would be unheated, and they would have to keep the lights off, or someone might report a breaking and entering. But despite these discomforts, surely there was a thrill in being unchaperoned. Why? Wondered Homer Wells. He knew he still wouldn't get to Deborah Pettigrew, even if she had two vaginas. With the dull Friday evening they had spent together, and with the dog's breath crystallizing on the driver's side window of the van, there was no talk about such a tempting party this night. "So what are we doing tomorrow night?" Deborah asked, sighing. Homer watched a dog gnaw at his side-view mirror. "Well, I was going to see Candy. She's home from Camden," Homer said. "I haven't seen her on a weekend all fall, and Wally did ask me to look after her." "You're going to see her without Wally?" Deborah asked. "Right," Homer said. The van was so snub-nosed that the dogs could hurl themselves directly against the windshield without having to clamber over the hood. A big dog's paws raked one of the windshield wipers away from the windshield, releasing it with a crack. It looked bent. It wouldn't quite touch the surface of the glass anymore. "You're going to see her alone," Deborah said. "Or with her dad," Homer said.
"Sure," said Deborah Pettigrew, getting out of the van. She left the door open a little too long. A dog with the spade-shaped head of a Doberman charged the open door. It was half in the van, its heavy chest heaving against the passenger side seat, its frosty muzzle drooling on the gearshift box, when Deborah grabbed it by the ear and yanked it back, yelping, out of the van. "So long," said Homer Wells softly, after the door had slammed, after he had wiped the dog's frothy slobber off the gearshift knob. He drove by Kendall's Lobster Pound twice, but there was nothing to tell him whether Candy was home.
On the weekends when she came home, she took the train. Then Ray drove her back on Sunday. I'll call her tomorrow. Saturday, Homer thought. When Candy said that she wanted to see the Fred Astaire movie, Homer had no objections. I always wanted to see him, he said. Bath, after all, was less than an hour away. On the bridge across the Kennebec River, they could see several big ships in the water and several more in dry dock. The Bath shipyards were sprawled along the shore. A rhythmic hammering and other metal sounds audible even on a Saturday. They were much too early for the movie. They were looking for an Italian restaurant that Ray had told them about. If it was still there, Raymond Kendall hadn't been in Bath in years. In 1940-something, especially to an outsider, the city seemed dominated by the shipyards, and by the ships that stood taller than the shipyard buildings, and by the bridge that spanned the Kennebec River. Bath was a working man's town, as Melanie soon discovered. She found a job in the shipyards and began her winter employment on an assembly line, working with other women, and with an occasional handicapped man, on the second floor of a factory specializing in movable parts. The movable part to which Melanie would devote her energies for the first month of her employment was a hexagonal-shaped sprocket that looked like half a ham split open lengthwise. Melanie did not know the whereabouts of the assembly line that dealt with the other half of the ham. The sprocket arrived on the conveyor belt in front of her, pausing there for exactly 45 seconds before it was moved on and replaced by a new sprocket. The joint of the sprocket was packed with grease. You could stick your finger in the grease past the second knuckle. The job was to insert 6 ball bearings into the grease-packed joint. You pushed each ball bearing into the grease until you felt it hit the bottom. All 6 fit perfectly. The trick was to get only one hand greasy. A clean hand had an easier time handling the clean ball bearings, which were the size of marbles. The other part of the job was making sure that the 6 ball bearings were perfect, perfectly round, perfectly smooth, no dents, no jagged metal scraps stuck to them. The odds were that 1 out of every 200 ball bearings had something wrong with it. At the end of the day, you turned in the bad ball bearings. If you had a day with no bad ball bearings, the foreman told you that you weren't looking each ball bearing over carefully enough. You could stand or sit, and Melanie tried both positions, alternating them through the day. The belt was too high to make sitting comfortable, and too low to make standing any better. Your back hurt in one place when you stood and in another place when you sat. Not only did Melanie not know who did what, where, to the other half of the sprocket, she also did not know what the sprocket was for. What's more, she didn't care. After 2 weeks, she had the routine down pat. Between 26 and 28 seconds to insert the ball bearings, and never more than 10 seconds to pick 6 perfect ball bearings. She learned to keep a nest of ball bearings in her lap, when she sat, and in an ashtray, she didn't smoke, when she stood. That way she always had a ball bearing handy in case she dropped one. She had a 12 to 14 second rest between sprockets, during which time she could look at the person on her left and at the person on her right, and shut her eyes and count to 3 or sometimes 5. She observed that there were 2 styles of labor on the line. Some of the workers picked their 6 perfect ball bearings immediately upon finishing a sprocket. The others waited for the new sprocket to arrive first. Melanie found faults with both styles. The woman next to Melanie put it this way. "Some of us are pickers, some are stickers," she said. "I'm not either, or I'm both," Melanie said. "Well, I think you'll have an easier time of it, dearie, if you make up your mind," the woman said. Her name was Doris. She had 3 children. One side of her face was still pretty, but the other side was marred by a mole with whiskers in it. In the 12 or 14 seconds that Doris had between sprockets, she smoked. On the other side of Melanie was an elderly man in a wheelchair. His problem was that he could not pick up the ball bearings that he dropped, and some of them got caught in his lap blanket or in the wheelchair apparatus, which caused him to rattle when he wheeled himself off for his coffee break or for lunch. His name was Walter. 3 or 4 times a day, Walter would shout, "Fucking ball bearings!" Some days, when someone was sick, the assembly line was reassembled and Melanie was not pinned between Walter and Doris. Sometimes she got to be next to Troy, who was blind. He felt the ball bearings for perfection and daintily poked them into the thick and unseen grease. He was a little older than Melanie, but he had always worked in the shipyards. He'd been blinded in a welding accident, and the shipyards owed him a job for life. "At least I've got security,"
he would say 3 or 4 times a day.
Some days Melanie was put next to a girl about her age, a feisty little chick called Lorna.